You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including Netflix streaming, Brent Spiner in the next JJ movie, some Trek game and movie news, Ships of the Line, the Tricorder X Prize, and Ira Stephen Bear talking Deep Space Nine. Our guests this week are Trek veterans Dave Rossi, Doug Mirabello, and Jose Munoz of Zero Room Productions to discuss their proposed Star Trek animated series, Final Frontier. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you today?
I'm doing great. It's actually sunny outside for the first time in weeks, it feels like.
Oh, really? Well, you stole our sun. It is gloomy here, but I have to say I'm loving it because it's actually quite cool.
Ah, nice.
Very comfortable. And the birds are going crazy outside. We'll see if anyone can hear them on the podcast here today.
Oh, you say the birds are tweeting. That's a lead into our first news story today.
Yeah, the birds are tweeting, and they're not the only ones tweeting. Jonathan Frakes is tweeting, as we talked about last show a little bit, but we have some news on that front.
Yes, so we were talking last week about whether Riker's going to go beardless or bearded for his avatar, and he's gone?
He has gone bearded, but it's a light bearded look.
It is pretty light. The hair on the top of his head's a little bit darker than his beard, which is, I'm afraid, is going to happen to me as well.
It's already happening to me, so I can associate with him very well. This is an interesting image that he took here. I have to say it's very Riker-esque from the movies. But I love the look he's got going here. It's kind of like he's looking at the screen from an angle, maybe using photo booth and thinking, is this thing working?
Yes.
Well, we'll put a link to this image anyway in the show notes.
Yeah.
Or you can just go over to Twitter and see it unless he changes it by the time this show comes out.
I like to imagine that he's using photo booth and he has those birds from OS X Lion just circling around his head.
Oh, yes.
He looks into the camera.
That's perfect for this. I love the fact that they showed off that feature in the keynote, by the way. And by the way, we have this new effect, birds circling your head. Anyway. So Frakes has his avatar now, and I'm just looking forward to seeing what happens in his Twitter stream.
Yeah, and maybe we'll get Marina Sirtis on Twitter pretty soon as well.
Yeah, and speaking
of her,
rounding
out that cast.
There's another news story here. This is a fun story that Troy definitely would love, and in fact, I'm thinking that this is the origin of a piece of technology that's on the Enterprise. Mm. Installed in Troy's quarters that we've never seen on the show.
Is that the sonic shower?
It's not the sonic shower. It's, in fact, a 3D chocolate printer.
Oh, even better.
That has been created by the University of Exeter in the UK. And this is actually a printer that prints in 3D using chocolate.
So I could make anything chocolate.
You can make anything chocolate.
Wow.
It's there for your creative genius.
The possibilities are endless, actually.
Yes, they are. But, you know, whenever Troy's feeling down, she goes for chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
And if this technology already exists in the year 2011, I have to believe that it's been refined and perfected by the 24th century and something that she definitely has on hand.
I think definitely.
It's just interesting. I mean, obviously, this is loosely Star Trek related, but I just had to throw this in because, I mean, if you think about how researchers and scientists are inspired by the technologies of Star Trek, chances are one of these scientists loves Star Trek, loves Troy, and loves chocolate, and put all those three things together to come up with this.
I think it makes sense.
And whether this is the Dr. Ling Hao, who is the research lead on this project, I'm not sure. But I love his quote here, where he says that the printer, he believes that the printer is both low cost to run and is non-hazardous.
I hope it's non-hazardous. Last time I had hazardous chocolate, it didn't go well.
Right. So I hope he's right. And, you know, we've seen a number of these printers coming out over the past year or so. A printer that can print using cells, biological cells, has come out. And a number of things. So anyway, we'll put a note to the story in the show notes, and you can go and get your Troy chocolate on.
Right. And if you want to see, maybe you can look in the background of some scenes and see if you can spot Troy's 3D chocolate printer. You can turn it up on Netflix, which has finally started streaming Star Trek after teasing us for months.
Yeah, that's right. It's finally happening. And the TNG connection here is that this is actually the first time that TNG has been available digitally, because while the other series are on iTunes, TNG is not.
Yeah, I was trying to pull up Encounter at Farpoint for our discussion last week, and they had Voyager, Enterprise,
DS9.
I think they had even DS9, but not a single bit of TNG.
And of course, TOS is on there.
But oh, yeah.
No TNG. And, you know, some shows like Enterprise have been available for streaming before from CBS. Mm-hmm. I think when they were doing Intertube, maybe Enterprise was on there.
Oh, okay.
Or anyway, now it's CBS Digital something. It's called, they changed the name of it. Mm-hmm. And, of course, TOS has been on Hulu.
Right.
And some of the others maybe as well. We, of course, don't have access to any of this stuff over here in Japan because it's U.S. only.
I think I downloaded some TOS on my Xbox a couple years ago. So they've had this stuff various places.
Yeah. So this is the first time for TNG anyway. Mm-hmm. And it did start on July 1st. Apparently, they held off on it until the clock passed midnight in Hawaii, and then it came online because a few of our friends on Twitter were watching the clock and like refreshing Netflix as it passed midnight in their time zone, and they're like, "No, there's still no Trek on Netflix. There's still no Trek on Netflix."
Yeah,
and finally, as the July 1st came to pass in Hawaii, it came online.
Yeah, I'd love to see the statistics of the 4th of July weekend, how many people were just sitting and just watching Star Trek nonstop instead of doing anything else.
I bet there was quite a spike. That's always interesting to me because I have all the seasons of every series on DVD in box sets, and I'm sure there are many, many fans who are the same, at least for their preferred series. But yet, when things like this come out, we always jump at them as fans anyway. It's like, we have the DVD box sets, but oh my gosh, it's available on Netflix.
Right.
So now you're going to go and you're going to like watch it there too. You know, it's like when it was on iTunes, I got some of the shows from iTunes just because it was available on iTunes. And like, I already have them on DVD and I can rip them and I can convert them.
Right.
And I can put them on my iPhone, my iPod, but still, it's just like eating up any Star Trek that comes out. So I bet there was a spike.
Yeah. Well, there's something spontaneous about just being able to go and grab one episode rather than having to go through all your DVDs and pull up the menu and go to the episode.
Yes.
So
absolutely,
that definitely would be very fun.
That's why I converted all of my DVD sets into MPEG, and I have them on my Apple TV and in iTunes.
Nice.
So I can just type in the name of any episode I want to see and pull it up. And it's like magic to me because I go back to the days when I used to buy the original series episodes on VHS tape from the bookstores in the 80s. And one episode per tape for $14.99. So all this stuff is just like, it is like magic that you can get things this way now.
Very magical. And of course, there are two caveats. The first caveat is that DS9 won't be available until October 1st.
Yep.
Not quite sure what the delay is on that. Maybe there's another deal
that
needs to expire. I don't know.
I think there's still all the cast members are still returning from the Gamma Quadrant, and it just takes them a bit longer to get here.
That makes perfect sense, Chris. And the other possibility, or the other caveat, is that it's U.S. only. There is Netflix streaming in at least Canada, and they're adding in some other Latin American countries, but to date, it's only U.S. for Star Trek.
Right. And you know, I found something interesting there. When I saw that, I actually went to the Netflix site.
Yeah.
I wanted to get a screenshot of the of Star Trek on Netflix itself. And they have a little note at the bottom. If you log into Netflix and you're not in the US, you get a special screen that tells you that it's not available in your country. But then there's a little link that says, I have a US address, something like that, which of course I have a US address
as well. Yeah.
So I clicked on it, and apparently if you have a US address, you can sign up for Netflix and you can receive DVDs by mail. I'm like, okay, so I can you're going to send me DVDs internationally and I'm going to send them back to you when I'm done watching them, but I can't stream.
But they won't let you that, man.
Yeah. It's and of course, mess. I know all of the distribution, licensing that goes behind all this stuff. I've worked in publishing for years and years. I know what goes on, but I just find it amusing that they would actually send me physical discs overseas, but yet I can't watch the stuff streaming online. But hopefully within a few years, as licenses get updated to the 21st century, hopefully some of this stuff's gonna smooth out. And because we've seen it start happening with sports a little bit. You know, we're able to get NFL. We're able to get ESPN programming overseas now.
Right.
Which is the flip. You can't sign up for those services if you're in the United States.
Right.
but I've seen a little bit of progress going there. So hopefully with, with things like Star Trek and other TV shows, we're going to get that at some point in the future as well.
I hope so.
A couple of other quick points on here. Some things that people might not think about immediately. TOS and Enterprise are both available in 720p HD. Of course, with TOS, you can get that on Blu-ray and you can get the HD. But with Enterprise right now, you can only get the standard DVD box sets. So if you watch Enterprise through the streaming on Netflix, you're actually going to get a better picture quality than you would from your DVDs.
Right. And they've been doing that on some of the HD cable stations and on Xbox. They also had it on HD. But to actually have a copy of it... kind of pseudo-physically, at least on your computer. It'll be nice. This is the first time it'll be streaming in high quality for sure.
Right. So that's a nice little touch there. Yeah. All right. Well, again, you'll be able to watch this on any Netflix-enabled devices. Those include all iOS devices. So iPad, iPhone, iPod Touch, Apple TV 2, which is iOS-based. Android devices that are enabled for Netflix, PS3, Xbox, Wii, and of course the Windows 7 Mobile Device Edition phone series devices will be able to play this as well.
Oh, that's great. Now I have a question. Will it be available on those consoles on the bridge of the Enterprise D so that as Data is tapping away looking for life forms, will he be able to watch Star Trek?
You know, I think he will, and in fact, I think the Enterprise, I'm not sure about the D, but I'm pretty sure that the E has the feature enabled where they can pipe it through the main view screen.
Ooh, nice.
So the whole bridge, they can replicate some popcorn, sit back and watch themselves and kind of critique their own performances, like, what could we have done differently to prevent the asteroid from coming so close to the planet?
Right.
How can we keep Q off the ship next time? So forth. And also, for TOS fans, I believe there is a feature where Spock is going to be able to watch this in his little science viewer.
Nice.
Very good. That's what's going on in Spock's viewer.
Just make sure Worf doesn't shoot the screen.
Yes. Well, speaking of watching these things on the bridge of the Enterprise D and Data...
Yes.
Brent Spiner has said that he would like to be in the next J.J. Abrams movie.
Yeah. Now, obviously, we know Data isn't old enough, and he played Arik Singh in Enterprise, and he would be too old, but Brent Spiner says he wants to find some way, maybe another one of his ancestors could pop up in Star Trek, put quotes around it, Star Trek II.
Yeah, Star Trek II. Yeah, he was asked about if Spiner would play Data again, if he were asked, and of course, that wouldn't work in canon anyway because they discovered Data. But also, he says he's just too old. He says, "Look at me, I am a shockingly older gentleman.
Yeah.
I don't see that I could wear that makeup anymore. I think that would look really stupid."
Yeah, even Nemesis, I think, was the extent of Spiner's ability to play Data.
Yeah, he was starting to look a little bit too old for the character.
Yeah, sort of like Sean Connery in that last Bond film.
Yeah, it worked, but like you said, it was kind of getting to the limit of it. But as for what he might play in the next Enterprise or in the next JJ movie, I kind of took his comment as saying that his character from Enterprise of Arik Soong might be able to appear. But Arik Soong was actually fairly young in that three-parter Enterprise.
I think he was supposed to be pretty young. And I guess if you consider McCoy was 137 in the TNG pilot. People are living quite a long time. Maybe he could show up in some maybe old age makeup if he needs it and be Arik Soong. I definitely would love to see that. I loved his character on Enterprise. That was one of the better of the three-part arcs in that last season.
Yeah, that was an interesting story, which also finally gave us the explanation of why Klingons in the original series had no forehead ridges. But I don't know. I mean, this could work okay for me, just in terms of bringing a character forward, because it's not a main character that kind of overshadows everything's happening in the movie. But But I don't know. I mean, I guess it could be interesting whether I kind of don't think it would happen. But he says that he would like everyone to start a campaign, maybe right here, right now. he wants to call the campaign BBS, Bring Back Soong. And he wants everyone to flood J.J. Abrams' offices with this. Just simply, BBS, Bring Back Soong. Just ping that over and over to J.J. Abrams' office on behalf of Brent Spiner. And see if you can get him cast in the next movie.
Yeah, this sounds like one of those letter writing campaigns, or even where fans will send an object that references the show to a studio to get the show either not canceled or bring it back for another season. So I'm trying to figure out what we could send to the studio offices to bring back Soong. And here's what I'm thinking. What's the one Data object that just keeps showing up? It's a prosthetic Brent Spiner head.
Oh my gosh. So everyone get a prosthetic Brent Spiner head.
Yes.
And put this in a box and ship it to J.J. Abrams' office. So at some point when he's received, you know, like 10,000 prosthetic Brent Spiner heads, that's when they're going to cave and they're going to cast Brent in the next movie.
Exactly, Chris. Exactly.
I see. See, I thought you were going to say genetically altered cats. Like laser cats.
That can work too.
Because Spot is always showing up in Data's quarters.
Yep.
So
laser
cats. I think if I received a bunch of laser cats, it'd get my attention.
I'd basically do whatever you wanted if you sent me a laser cat.
Oh man. Well, okay. Well, speaking of the next movie, we also have a little bit of news about the next movie related to the game, which was unveiled at E3, and which has already won 5 awards at E3, by the way, including the Best Awesome. So what kind of news do we have here?
Well, we have some actually breaking news from Roberto Orci. He says that they are going to kill Spock.
Yeah. Okay. Everyone has just thrown something at the speakers here, I think. Okay, so what do you mean they're going to kill Spock? What was the question that was asked exactly?
Right, I believe they asked him if they're going to kill Spock in the game. And he said, maybe, both in the game and in the sequel that we're doing. And by the way, he says, we consider them both very seriously together. So I think he's not being entirely serious when he says they're going to kill Spock. But it is interesting that they're thinking of the game and the movie together as similar to the comic book series that is in the works. They're thinking of ways to flesh out this new parallel, alternate, I suppose, universe. And part of that will be this game.
Right, exactly. And that answers one question that we had asked last time when we talked about this, was whether there would be a connection. And I think we both felt that it would be unlikely that they would release this game in the same year that the movie is likely to be released as well, ahead of the movie, without there being any connection at all to it. And on that point, you know, it's interesting that this was an interview that was done in GamePro magazine, because this game is featured on the cover of the latest issue of GamePro magazine. And they asked him to weigh in on whether the game will be part of, well, first, would it be connected to the movie, and would it be part of canon?
Right.
And Orky said that it's true. He said that true fans will tell you that canon is only what's filmed. He said, "I'm not an authority on what is canon. However, I will tell you that this may be the first game that falls within the parameters of the people who are in charge of canon, for now. The Supreme Court, as we call ourselves, because we are the ones in charge of Star Trek, for now."
Right.
Right. And he says that he can tell you that they are thinking about this as they generate content for both the game and the movie, and that they would not allow a game to go out if it was not somehow part of the continuity.
Right. And I think it's important that they seem to be considering it. Maybe it won't be official canon, but they don't want it to contradict anything that will happen in the movie, and they don't want the movie to contradict the game.
Right, and so Jackson is not going to be sitting at the con.
No, that'd be game, awesome. Right? I want to play Kirk, Spock, or Jackson.
Yeah, three choices. It'll say on the box, playable Jackson. If you pre-order, you get a special playable Jackson.
Yeah, pre-order bonus. Perfect. Better than the pre-order bonus I got for Duke Nukem.
Oh, gosh.
So,
what was that? Was it like a trinket from the 80s when they started developing the game?
That's exactly. So, there are things in Star Wars. Obviously, the true fans of Star Wars will tell you only the movies are canon. I guess the truest fans will only tell you that the original versions of the original films are canon.
Right, but, and so much more of Star Wars has been told in the books compared to the percentage of Star Trek told in the books versus on screen. Yeah,
but there are books that I think most fans would consider canon. Some of them not so much, but the ones that don't go, at least don't go out of their way to contradict things that happened in the movies, have a better chance of being accepted by the larger community. And it's good to see them going that way with the comic books and the game here.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And it does seem to be a trend that they established with the comics and moving forward. And it's not just, I think a lot of that comes from the fact that we have J.J. Abrams and the Bad Robot team behind this, because, you know, one of the key, what they like to do, in a way, they're kind of like George Lucas was in the 70s, which Star Wars kind of pioneered this tie-in of the movies and the marketing.
Right.
J.J. Abrams and Bad Robot has been very much like that with a lot of the stuff that they've done. You know, Lost was kind of supplemented by a website that filled in a lot of the gaps from the shows. And so much of what was done with Lost depended on the marketing elements and the supplemental material to bring it all together. And you're kind of seeing that to a lesser extent coming into what he's doing with the Star Trek reboot.
Yeah, very cool to see a larger universe being created, because it's hard when you just have one movie coming out every, you know, 3 to 8 years if it keeps getting delayed. It's hard to keep that bigger universe going on, so it's good that they're making an effort to expand it.
Yeah, exactly, and that they themselves are doing it as opposed to the way the rest of Star Trek keeps going through the books right now, where, you know, you do have authors who are writing these books who have been writing for a long time, but some of what happens, it just deviates so much from Star Trek that you can enjoy it as a Star Trek fan, but you also have to kind of keep it separated from from the canon, you know, as we say. So
that's why online we have Memory Alpha and then Memory Beta, which they're completely separate, where you have one that talks about canon and one that talks about the rest of the stuff, because it's iffy from here.
Yeah, because some of it fits in well, but a lot of it just doesn't.
All right, so talking about sort of somewhat canon, somewhat fan fiction-y things, and also a lot of the books, we have Doug Drexler's blog. Now, are you familiar with Doug Drexler?
I am, a bit. I think you may be a little bit more familiar with what he's doing than I am. Yeah.
Well, I wish I could tell you exactly what he did on various Star Trek shows, but he's been with Star Trek for years and years, working in the art department, working in the makeup department, and working in the model department. So he knows everybody involved, and he's also now working on a lot of the images for the books. Often you'll see one of the new books has a the new starship on the cover or some computer-generated thing. And that will probably have gone through his office.
Right,
and he
right.
also he also works on this Ships of the Line calendar, which I always love seeing it at the bookstore back when I was in the States. I don't think they sell it here in Japan.
They do in Tokyo, but yeah, probably not in your area.
But as a calendar, maybe it's not the greatest calendar, but there's these beautiful depictions of starships. And
right, yeah. It's what I call, it's the calendar that's not really a calendar. But
right.
But it is beautiful. It's a great thing to hang up on your wall because the ships are absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, so what Doug does every year, he's been doing this for a couple years on his blog that we'll link to in the show notes, is he's put up some of the images and also had guest bloggers come in to talk about the images they made for the 2012 Ships of the Line calendar. And there are just some amazing images in here. I have a couple of them as my background right now. There's one of the USS Allegiance sort of on fire as it flees a Borg cube. And there's another image from, which was the TOS episode where they went back in time and there was a U.S. Air Force fighter sort of flanking the Enterprise.
That's Tomorrow is Yesterday.
There we go. And Tomorrow is Yesterday. So there's a great recreation of that scene. And there's actually a lot more. So I have, as my wallpapers right now, pretty much all my wallpapers on my computer are from this. And they're just really astonishing.
Yeah, like you said, he's put a number of images up on his blog, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. Mm. And it's interesting here, he has some images of Ambassador class, which looks a little bit like a revision of the Ambassador class that we're familiar with, because the Enterprise C is an Ambassador class.
Yeah, there's an interesting story here. I can tell a small portion of it, that they originally, in season one, they were coming up on TNG. They were coming up with some concepts for what the Enterprise D would look like and also what the Enterprise C would look like. And they drew one. Oh, I forget his name, but one of their designers drew an image of this. And it sort of stuck around until the season 3 episode where they actually showed the Enterprise C. And that one, I remember, was called Yesterday's Enterprise.
That's right.
But they changed the design. Just to make it more easy for the model makers to do it. It was a big hassle to make a whole new ship in those days. So they changed to make it a little bit easier to film and to design. And I think it lost a little bit of what made the original design so special. And so what Doug and this artist have gone back and done is create a new 3D model of the original Ambassador class design. And
okay.
I think it's pretty awesome looking.
It is. I love this design. It has more character than what we saw in yesterday's Enterprise. It's a really beautiful design. Would have loved to have seen this on screen.
Yeah. Yeah. So hopefully, you know, if they do TNG remastered, maybe they'll bring this model in to replace it.
That would be really cool. That would be very cool if they did that.
Currently, the model they have, while it's a nice model, it looks very TNG era, it looks a little bit too generic.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, also on here, they have a little bit of discussion with a designer named Dan Mad Koi Fish Ueno, who has done several ships for this 2012 Ships of the Line calendar, including the USS Balmung and the USS Mugi, and also a Work Bee. And the Work Bee is a ship that is often talked about, at least in Star Trek reference material. It's the little ship that they go and do some like exterior work on the ships when they need to repair things.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a cool little thing. And what I really like here, one image on this blog, is that they have an image of a work bee being deployed with a cargo pod coming out of a compartment on the ship. And it puts the size perspective of the work bee.
Yeah.
Versus its parent vessel into something that's it's really astonishing, the size difference here. That's a great image. But they ask him a little bit about his work on here. And first there's this one quote that I think is really funny that Drexler says of Ueno, that, no kidding, this gentleman has an understanding of the Starfleet design ethic that would give Leia Brahm's hot flashes Geordi LaForge an inferiority complex and cause Scotty to wet his pants.
Like to get my hands on those ample nacelles, if you catch my meaning.
Right. Ueno says himself of working on these, he says, I quite enjoy working with these unseen eras of Star Trek, and I keep finding that I always return to them after exploring existing eras. Mm. And I think it's one of the nice things about the Ships of the Line calendar is being able to see ship designs that we don't get to see on screen because there's not an opportunity. And if you like to follow the progression of technology and ship design as the years would go by for Starfleet, the Ships of the Line calendar is a really great place to follow that evolution.
Yeah, it's cool. They've got everything from even TOS era stuff to in between TOS and Next Gen, and then even past the end of Voyager or even after Nemesis, they have images from brand
Beyond
new starships.
That, yeah. I think it's in the 20, I don't have the calendar, but I've read some stories on the development of, I believe, the 2011 Ships of the Line calendar, and the development of the USS Aventine, which is the ship that Captain Ezri Dax commands in the Star Trek Destiny book series.
Right.
But the ship was based on a shark, essentially.
Oh, wow.
And it's a very clear evolution of the Enterprise E and Voyager, going beyond that, like a continuation of this kind of aggressive, streamlined look in the Starfleet vessels, including some black coloring on the hull, black and gray coloring on the hulls that we haven't seen before that gives it a very predatory look.
What I'd really love to see them, instead of putting out a calendar, or maybe with the calendar, include just a CD of these image files in high resolution, because I really just want to use them as wallpapers on my computer more than I want to have them as a calendar.
What they should do is have a supplemental to the calendar, like a website that when you buy the calendar, you get some kind of special code. And they could do it because usually these calendars are sealed, so they could put the code inside where you can't just read it off the back in the bookstore.
Yeah.
And and then you go to the website and you can download these things, enter the code and download those wallpaper. That would be nice. So if you guys are listening, that's what we want.
Please
as
do.
Fans, please.
Yeah. But for now, you can go to the Drex files and find the images that are there. They're high enough resolution to use as wallpapers. And even look back through the past couple years, he has more images from previous calendars. So it's really great stuff to look at.
And you'll find a link in the show notes for that.
Right. Now, I think we need all of these ships to band together and go against the Death Star in our next story, which is about a new book by Matt Forbeck called Could the Empire Kick the Federation's Ass? Star Trek versus Star Wars.
Yes. This is a dangerous story here because I think we could do a three-part feature on Star Trek versus Star Wars if we really wanted to, you know. And I'm pretty sure there's a specific night in Sheldon and Leonard's apartment on the Big Bang Theory that's devoted exclusively to discussion of this topic.
Yes, I do believe so.
You know, I have to be honest with you. This is a topic that I always kind of roll my eyes at when it comes up because I know it can be fun, like the Enterprise versus the Death Star battles that are discussed, you know. I guess it's natural to kind of pit these two franchises together, and it's kind of fun to speculate on it. But, you know, the reality is Star Trek is science fiction and Star Wars is mythology. It's not science fiction because it takes place in space. There's this tendency to get into big debates over which is better, Star Trek or Star Wars.
Yeah.
So it's not a topic that I tend to discuss very often. But Forbeck has decided to tackle it in a new book that pits the two universes together. And he hopes to decide once and for all which one is better.
So he's actually gone through and pitted some of these overlapping things, put some ships against each other, put aliens against each other, and as a thought exercise, decide who would win. And then he, you know, takes down who won more battles, and I guess at the end of the book, he declares the winner.
Right. Okay. So it's a thought exercise in the sense of just kind of setting something up and let's see who wins.
Exactly.
But I'm not sure that he actually gets into it as a thought exercise in the sense of really, really delving into the details of each franchise to determine
right.
which one is stronger, for example, at perhaps telling stories,
right.
delving into issues that fans might find deeper meanings within, because they do both have deeper meanings
right.
within the stories. Mm-hmm. They're just kind of, they approach them from a different perspective.
Yeah, well, if you'd like to see some really in-depth discussion of the overarching themes of Star Wars and Star Trek and how they overlap, see my internet postings between ages 12 and 22, where I spent way too much time online. So we'll provide a link to all of that in the show notes.
Okay, we'll do that. And I'm a little bit worried that you were able to do internet postings when you were 12 years old.
It was a different time.
That's right.
Well, so while we're doing thought experiments, here's one battle I would love to see.
Okay.
And that is the Gorn captain versus Jar Jar Binks.
Oh my gosh, the Gorn captain would eat Jar Jar Binks for lunch. And that would be one of the shortest battles in history.
But what if Jar Jar constructed some sort of primitive weapon, like a diamond cannon?
Oh God. I think that the diamond would simply sharpen the Gorn's teeth.
It probably would.
Well, speaking of some place that has made good use of the Gorn, because
yes.
we only got to see the Gorn just a little bit on screen in Star Trek, mm-hmm. in TOS and Enterprise, Enterprise being a case where I think the Gorn captain would disown that Gorn.
Probably.
Is Star Trek Online.
Mm, yeah.
The Gorn do have a place in Star Trek Online. They even team up with the Klingons in a war against the Federation in the backstory to Star Trek Online's 25th century setting.
Yeah, it's quite cool. So I believe the reason we're talking about it this week is that they are offering it for 33% off, which means
right.
to buy the actual box, it's only about $10.
Right. This is the Digital Deluxe Edition.
Right.
Which has more or less become the standard edition
right.
of Star Trek Online. Initially, there was just Star Trek Online, and then there was the special deluxe edition,
right.
which, if I remember correctly, ran close to $70 or so when it first came out. It was pretty pricey. And what this is, though, is if you get the game through Steam, mm-hmm. which is the popular game service where you can purchase games digitally. And a nice thing about Steam is you can use them on all your systems, mm-hmm. even... Not in the case of STO, of course, because it's PC only, but a lot of Steam games have PC and Mac versions, and you buy it once, and you can use it on your PC
yeah.
and on your Mac, and you go back and forth.
Yeah.
Steam is where I got my STO, and I did download the Digital Deluxe Edition. I think it was about $30, which is what I guess the normal price would be here, because we're 33% off. $10.04 is what you would pay right now.
Mm-hmm.
And you get this. The Steam edition includes an exclusive phaser turret,
ooh.
Which is a tactical station mod that you can put on your ship. And you get a lot of other little special features in the Digital Deluxe edition. You get keys that you enter in STO to redeem these.
Right.
And tell us about a few of the other exclusives
yeah.
that you
so
can
I'm
get
looking
here.
At a bunch of this stuff, and it actually looks really cool. You can use some. You can get the original Star Trek uniforms. There's blue, red, and yellow uniforms. There's a exclusive Klingon blood wine toast, which I do every night, regardless of having STO or not.
Yeah, that's my nightcap.
You can get that unique registry prefix of NX, which only a few ships have ever had on screen. And you can get this special emote, which is a sound you can scream, I guess, at a pivotal moment. And before I say what it is, I want to also mention that this week also announced was that World of Warcraft is going free to play for the first 20 levels, which I believe probably made Cryptic scream, "Con!"
I'm sure, and maybe it will lead us to some free STO.
I hope so. I mean, if they will make it for Mac and preferably free to play so I can jump in and try yeah. a little bit... I will jump on it in a moment, but they still have a little bit too much of a barrier to get me in there. Although they're definitely trying.
They do right now, you know. I mean, I know, I see you trying to go in often, and you'll tweet to me, Con, because you can't get in yet because you've got to pay the monthly fee and everything.
Exactly.
But you know, actually, they are getting enough content now in STO. This week, actually, they're launching season 4, which is called Crossfire.
Right.
They've started doing these seasons on STO, a series of 5 or 6 episodes that make up a story. Mm-hmm. Now that they're going into season 4, and now that you have things like World of Warcraft going free to play for at least the first 20 levels, they could start doing something like STO free to play for the first 2 seasons.
Yeah.
Something like that. So they keep adding seasons, and if you're a member, you get the new seasons as they come out. If not, maybe after the new season's been out, say 6 months down the road, they roll a new season into the free-to-play. So they could have a tiered thing going there if they're not able to go just free-to-play across the board.
Yeah, but you'd think with so much of so many things you could have people buy in-game. I'm looking at the iOS, so like the iPhone, the iPad. So many of these games are free, but then there are things you purchase within the games. And those skyrocket the games to the top of the top grossing chart. I think 8 of the top 10 grossing games on the iOS store are actually, quote, free games, like Smurfs Village.
Yeah, exactly.
But once they get you in, suddenly you have to buy, you know, Smurf Berries or what, I guess whatever they'd call them in Star Trek Online.
You know, that's where I think it may be heading, too, because the price of STO has been dropping in terms of just buying the game itself.
Yeah.
And they do have so much add-on material now. I mean, they even have Horda. You can buy Horda now.
Oh, wow.
Summon in battle different types of Horda.
Can I mind meld with it?
I think you can. I mean, I know Spock would. So, but maybe we're headed to the point where STO becomes a free download. Mm-hmm. From Cryptic or Steam, you know, they could distribute through Steam.
Yeah.
And also the first, there's certain content that's free. Like I said, maybe the first couple of seasons are free. Mm-hmm. And they actually, instead of releasing these new seasons to everybody,
right?
They put the seasons themselves in the Cryptic store as an add-on. Obviously more expensive than buying uniforms or ships or so forth. But, you know, maybe it's like 1,000 Atari points gets you season 4 gameplay.
Right.
I hope that's where it's headed.
Right. So far we have, if the Ships of the Line people are listening, give us wallpapers. And if the guys from Cryptic are listening, give us free to play. So hopefully some people are going to start listening to us and we can get some of the stuff we want.
This is our Star Trek wish list.
Exactly.
So, well, you know, one aspect of Star Trek Online in the gameplay, of course, you have missions on the planets and so forth, but a lot of the gameplay focuses on space battle. And there's one ship in particular that's not available in the Cryptic store.
Not yet.
And for good reason, because this is a ship that you definitely don't want to go into battle with.
Yes.
And that is the Space Shuttle.
Yeah, the Space Shuttle, which, you know, the Space Shuttle has been around for years and years, and it's getting pretty old. And I guess now they're finally retiring the program, which is sad, but I think, like the original Enterprise, it was getting a bit long in the tooth.
Yeah, they have to finally bring it to an end for us to move forward.
Right.
To the next step in our exploration of space and our journey on the Star Trek timeline to finally get us to that Warp 5 ship that we talked about in the past.
Right, so to commemorate the bringing to an end of the Space Shuttle program, NASA has created a one-hour documentary about the Space Shuttle program, and they've gotten William Shatner, who we all know as Captain Kirk, gotten him to narrate this documentary.
And they finally, NASA released it this week on July 5th, on Tuesday.
So hopefully I'll get a chance to watch that this week. I love the Space Shuttle, and I'd love to know a little bit more about the history of it. So you know, you can click the link in our show notes and find out more yourself.
Yes, and speaking of the Space Shuttle, we talked about, or at least there was a news story that we had on Trek FM, I don't think we talked about it on the show here, about the iPhone 4 being used as a tricorder.
Right.
I think Endeavour is taking it up on their mission that's supposed to launch July 8th, the final mission of the shuttle program, taking a couple of iPhone 4s up to the International Space Station with some special software, and the astronauts are going to use these as tricorders to do some experiments, measure radiation, do so forth. And it's kind of the beginning, perhaps, of the next Star Trek technology. If you think of the iPad, you think of cell phones, things that have been inspired by Star Trek. Yeah. And to help this along, we've got something else that's going on here.
Yeah, so the XPRIZE Foundation, who we're spearheading a movement to have private organizations create a spacecraft, and I believe they've already given out that award. And,
yeah, that's actually gone very well to
it has.
Spur the private sector into developing spacecraft technology.
Yeah, so they've joined forces with Qualcomm for the interestingly named the Tricorder XPRIZE, which is actually a goal to create a mobile tricorder-like device that can diagnose patients, you know, as well as a doctor could. So exactly what McCoy would be holding in the original series.
Exactly, although I have a feeling it will be smaller.
I hope so.
And there's definitely no question here what inspired this.
Yeah.
No question that this is Star Trek inspired. And the prize is going to be $10 million. Mm. And this is a story that has been talked about just a little bit over the past couple of months, but it's good to see that it's finally, the details are being fleshed out. And it's supposed to launch in early 2012. And it's, I think, going to be a boon for the medical industry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, unlike the idea of trying to create propulsion that can lead us to warp technology, mm-hmm. Or even the XPRIZE for spacecraft, which mm-hmm. is, from an engineering standpoint, is, I think, even more challenging than this.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that I think we can expect to see come to fruition in a fairly short time frame.
Yeah, I think it definitely the bits are there. It's just a matter of getting everything together and miniaturizing it and make it a something that can definitely go into the field. Whereas now it might, many of these things might be separate technologies or might currently fill a room.
Yeah. I think we're a lot closer to it than we think we are. If you look at some of the stuff, specifically in the medical field, some of the stuff that's being deployed right now using cell phones in Africa, for example, for in the field treatments, it's very exciting. And you know, I hope they develop it soon, because we're going to need a tricorder when the prophets suck us into the wormhole and we find out that we're on the beach where we met our wives.
Yeah.
And that leads us to Deep Space Nine and our final news story for the day.
Yes. Sorry, let me grab my circle sunglasses and put on my goatee, because we are talking about Ira Stephen Bear.
That's right. Now, do you have your blue dye for your goatee there?
Shoot. I left it in the Gamma Quadrant.
Yeah, Ira Stephen Bear is a very interesting guy, and he's actually one of my favorite figures from Star Trek.
Definitely.
From the writing teams, because he's a real creative, and he has a very interesting mind, and he's one of the great minds behind Deep Space Nine.
Right.
Which became one of the most interesting parts of all of Star Trek to me.
I mean, they had him on board Next Gen for season 3. And he left Next Gen. He called it the Connecticut of Star Trek.
That was an interesting comment there.
And he just did not, he couldn't make those characters work.
Yeah, he said he felt creatively trapped on the Next Generation.
Yeah. So, but then Michael Piller basically begged him to come back for this new show that they were putting together. I believe they had all the characters. They had the Bible written. And they gave it to him and said, look, this is much more your style. This is something we think you can really do something with. And he did actually manage to come back.
Yeah, it was, you know, Piller said to him, as DS9 was billed prior to launch, when people were talking about this new Star Trek series that's coming out, that it was going to be a darker, grittier Star Trek. And he told Bear that this is going to better represent your view of things.
Mm.
And I mean, I think that Bear didn't immediately jump on the opportunity, but when he did kind of read the Bible and find out what was going on, and he told Piller things like, look, you know, if I come on and I do this, I'd want to take O'Brien and Amoros, which was the original name of Bashir's character. Mm-hmm. I'm going to want to make them best buddies, even though they're totally different characters and they don't get along at first. And he said he'd really like to explore a friendship on Star Trek that doesn't have to do with the fact that here's number one, and this guy's a Vulcan, and they're always on the bridge together, and they have to work together, and there's the chain of command, and that makes them friends. Mm. You know, he wants to just kind of explore these avenues of Star Trek that kind of depart from what has been done over and over in the past.
And I think as we get into talking about the later seasons of DS9, we're going to talk about that O'Brien-Bashir friendship as being one of the great pillars of DS9, one of the things that kept me coming back episode after episode.
Yeah, it is. It's one of many, and that's what's amazing about Deep Space Nine and what Bear and the rest of the writing team was able to do on this show, mm-hmm. is that there are so many things like that running through DS9,
right.
That made it so rich, and of course made it difficult to wrap it up
right.
over the course of the last season, because there were so many storylines that had been taken care of.
But yeah, I said that was interesting with the Dominion War, that they knew they only had a few more years left of the show, and he just wanted to do something big and just really blow out the show and do this, what ended up being a great experiment into serialized television.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting there to say that we only have a few more years
right.
left of the show,
no.
you know, because often these things don't get addressed until you're already in the last season and you think, we only have a few more episodes
right.
of this show and we have to tie everything
right.
up. And, and you kind of get that feeling a little bit on TNG that
definitely
like, as the seventh season went on, you weren't really quite sure. I mean, of course, the show wasn't serialized in the way that DS9 was, so there wasn't as much to tie up, but
right.
you start kind of wondering, like, do you feel like you're getting closure, or you do you just feel like you're kind of heading towards there's not going to be another episode after this last one kind of thing? So.
Yeah, I'm reminded of an episode of The West Wing when the chief of staff, nearing the end of the president's terms in office, just gets everybody together and puts a whiteboard in front of them and writes the number 100 on the whiteboard. And he says, look, we've got 100 days. We've got to do something with these days. And I feel like that's what Bear did with the writing staff of DS9.
Yeah, let's do something with it. And, you know, he said, they asked him in this interview, I guess we should mention here that...
Oh, we should.
We're talking about this because Ira Stephen Bear sat down with StarTrek.com mm-hmm. to do one of their two-part interviews.
Yeah.
To talk about his new show that's coming up for sci-fi called Alphas, but also largely to talk about Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
And they asked him, why do you think DS9 worked? Or what worked on DS9? And for fans like me, I think DS9 worked very well. He says that they told a story over 7 years. You know, this was a series that had a beginning, it had a middle, mm-hmm. and it had an ending.
Definitely.
And it definitely did. And I don't know if it was 100% by design, you know, sitting down at the beginning of the series and charting out what's going to happen over 7 years. But they definitely set things up really well right off the bat. And I noticed this as I was watching Emissary a couple of days ago, mm-hmm. that whether they set up elements of the Bajoran religion and Sisko's role as the emissary and as essentially a child of the prophets, whether they set all this stuff up knowing where they were going to end it mm-hmm. in What You Leave Behind, or whether it was just set up and they just kind of grab onto it in the middle of the series and flesh it out, it all really works really, really well.
Yeah, it definitely does. I mean, some shows just give you characters and then they find out what to do with the characters later, and some shows just put actors on the screen and then hope that something eventually happens with them. Whereas this show, I really feel like it had people with specific arcs right off the bat, especially someone like Bashir, who was very unlikable to start. And I believe it was an interview with Bear from before. He said they wanted to start Bashir out being someone you didn't like, so that when they made you eventually like him, it was an arc. He didn't just start off as a likable guy.
Yeah. Yeah, so we're going to talk a lot more about DS9 on some upcoming shows, and we'll get into all those details. One other thing that I just want to mention here from this interview is that, because I said before that I think DS9 was the perfect series mm-hmm. to make movies out of, and they did ask him that, would you ever do more DS9 in the
right.
future, you know, if there was a chance to do that? And he said that if that ever became reality, which he thinks it's hard to imagine that it would, and I agree with him based mm-hmm. on how the series ended.
Yes.
He did say that there is a big part of him that would like to go back to that world and those characters, you know, and play in that world again, and that he really misses a lot of those characters. And he says, so would I say no? I don't think I'd say no. So yeah. There's still a lot of love for that in him, I think. And he's done a lot of series since ending DS9. Mm-hmm. He worked on Dark Angel, the newer Twilight Zone, Dr. Vegas, Crash, and the 4400. Mm-hmm. And the 4400, especially for me, is a series that I really like. And that I think, even though it's really different because it takes place in modern day on Earth, I always felt a lot of DS9 flavor in the 4400.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Just from the style of the writing, the way of telling stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that when I watched the 4400, I got that bare connection in there.
Mm-hmm.
So I really can see where he has a strong feeling about the work that he did on DS9.
Yeah.
And how it's unique in telling stories within the overall Star Trek franchise.
Interesting. Yes, I'm definitely looking forward to seeing Alphas on Sci-Fi and seeing what he does. I did like the 4400, but I never really got into it. And by the time I did, it was kind of too late.
It's a show where you get the DVDs and you just...
Right.
Because each season is short.
Mm-hmm.
You just get all the DVDs and you just watch it straight through.
Yeah. So yeah. Someday I'll do that. And also, I believe Alphas is premiering later this year, so I'll jump right into that. But maybe if he returns to Star Trek and does some more things with the DS9 characters, hey, he could do the Ezri Dax TV show that you're looking forward to.
Star Trek Aventine.
Yes.
Now it'll probably be called Star Trek Destiny. All right. Well, that wraps up all our news today, Craig.
Yes, it does. And Chris, last week you had a trivia question for me. So this week I have a math question for you.
Oh, no. You know math is my worst subject.
Oh, well, I think you might get this one.
All right, you're scaring me here.
What do you get when you add Star Trek, okay, animation, the 26th century, space bugs, and a Spatula Enterprise?
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so we have Star Trek. I'm going to represent that by S. Animation is going to be A. We have 26. Okay, so we see S plus A plus 26. Carry the bugs. I got a zero. Oh, I got it. I know what it is. It's our guests for this week. It's Zero Room Productions.
You've got it.
On a previous show, we discussed the future of Star Trek on television, and one of the concepts we touched on was an animated series called Final Frontier. And we're very pleased today to have with us the team from Zero Room Productions that put together the concept, Dave Rossi, Jose Munoz, and Doug Mirabello. Welcome to the Ready Room, guys.
Hi, guys. Hi. Thank Welcome. You.
Hi.
Great. It's great to have you here. And we're really excited to talk to you more about this Final Frontier concept that... Greg and I didn't really know a whole lot about this until we started researching different concepts that had been put together. And this one in particular we thought was quite interesting, especially because we were going towards animation again. First question I had for you guys, I was wondering, because Dave, you and Doug both worked on Star Trek for many years.
Mm-hmm.
Dave, you're going back to TNG even. And Jose, you're also from television production. And did you guys all meet as a result of working on live action Star Trek?
We did.
Yeah. Yeah. We all worked.
I hired Jose.
Yep. And okay. And Doug, right?
And Doug, but I think there's more Rick that
was,
hired
I think
Doug,
it was my charm and skill, the job that got me that, but I'm sure a good word for
that's what he
helped.
Thinks. And Jose got the job because he came in wearing a Green Lantern ring.
That is true.
Although that. Jose and I didn't work on Star Trek at the same time.
Yeah.
But
no,
we
no,
eventually okay. ended up meeting through a poker game that kind of coalesced.
Was that the poker game where Stephen Hawking was involved as well?
it was we actually played on the holodeck set.
Hawking cheats, by the way.
Oh, yeah, okay. No, yeah, we all worked. Yeah, we at one point in time we all worked at Star Trek.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Excellent.
Yeah, my tenure was last season of Deep Space Nine, Insurrection, and I think what the fourth or fifth season of Voyager sounds about right.
Did you have any involvement in deciding to dress the Breen like Princess Leia as Bosch for the last season of Deep Space Nine?
I take no responsibility for anything that happened in the last season of Deep Space Nine.
All right. So when did you guys first start thinking about the idea of doing an animated Star Trek show?
Yeah, I want to know about this too, because I'd seen the Genndy Tartakovsky Clone Wars show, and I loved that. And I heard you guys had that as a bit of an influence.
Yeah, I think I loved that that series, and I thought, you know, Star Trek's a little less action-y at its core, a little more plot-driven, and but that animation style worked so well, and I remember approaching Doug about it, and we had actually worked on a previous concept for an animated show for Star Trek that took place in the original series timeline on another ship, and it kind of, you know, we were kind of pleased with the story, I think, by the end, but it fell apart for various reasons. And then separately, Jose and I were having dinner one night, and I said to him, "How would you fix Star Trek?" And we got into this
a big question.
Yeah, it was a big question. It was a big dinner, and we got into a discussion about it, and it turned out that Jose and I had a lot of the same thoughts about breaking the Federation down, and not just simply, you know, a new ship with new uniforms and the same mission, and, you know, we felt that there needed to be a fundamental shift towards what made Star Trek good in its earlier days, and the idea of exploration and all of that sort of thing, and Doug and I had been working, so the three of us came together and started working on it. That sound about right, guys?
Yeah, and it's important to remember that this was obviously before the J.J. Abrams movie had even been announced.
Yeah, right.
So, I mean, the franchise at that point was festering away, I guess, best way to put it.
It was just in limbo. Nobody really knew, you know, what was going to be next. It was in various stages of legal dispute as CBS and Paramount were breaking up, and it was just kind of lying there waiting for somebody to do something. And when we talked about it, it was the biggest thing was we wanted it to go forward. And the other thing was that not that we wanted to push the reset button, but when you go back to the original series, they hadn't already sort of become masters of the universe. They hadn't explored it, you know, a lot, and they hadn't seen a lot, and they didn't have the technology hadn't gotten so advanced yet. It's still you know, transporters and phasers and warp speed and all that stuff, but those are very basic concepts. By the time you get to Voyager and even parts of Next Generation, they're doing crazy stuff, and we wanted to bring it back to that space should have a sense of wonder and all of that. But at the same time, we want Star Trek should always be looking, at least in my opinion, it should always be looking forward. It should always be, the next thing should be what's the next thing in human evolution and exploration. And that's kind of why how we got to where we got.
And you know, the more we talked about it, the more we started. I you know, I'm a child of the original series, and that will always be my favorite series. But as we all got together and started talking about what made that show work and what was interesting about it, it led us to all these things about, you know, the fact that they are out there on the frontier alone, that there's not always help, that you can't just turn around and return to Earth within 2 days. You know, and the decisions you make are far-reaching decisions, and you make them by yourself because it takes 3 weeks for a message to get back. And, you know, we started getting to this whole kind of fundamental thing that made those shows so intriguing and fun and awe-inspiring, and that led us down this road.
Yeah, and for us, seemingly the best way to achieve that sort of level of tension and sparseness to the universe was to break it down, to break down the Federation, to break down sort of all the things that we know, move a couple of pieces around, and start over.
Yeah,
in a sense.
It seems like the way Star Trek was going was sort of the opposite direction of everyone was becoming friends, warp drive was getting faster and faster. So what did you get a lot of resistance when you pitched this to your concepts?
Well, no, I don't think we did. You know, the original concept was we were going to do these as online internet shorts through StarTrek.com. And we had several meetings with them, and they loved it. I mean, they had us running out to animation companies and getting budgets, and it went pretty far down the road. We'd also had talks. You know, the problem was CBS and Paramount had just split into two separate companies, and the divorce was very messy in that things like Star Trek, which were movies and also TV shows, left kind of a gaping hole in who had ownership to do certain things.
Yeah, because they split those, right? Paramount has the film and CBS has the TV now.
Exactly, right? And it's the same thing for like Mission Impossible, which is a TV show that CBS owns, but we do the movie. Paramount does the movies. So so it was a very tumultuous time where everyone was trying to figure out the legality of what was happening. And in the internet world was just a no man's land. Nobody knew who had the rights to do anything. So we initially started by talking to, I think it was Paramount Home Video.
Yeah, we had discussed doing it. We're also big fans of some of the DC Comics direct-to-DVD animated films. So we had talked about doing it that way. We had a particularly disastrous pitch with with home video. The thing about StarTrek.com was the guys who ran that were Star Trek fans. And so when they heard the idea, it wasn't just, how can we monetize this? And how can we? It was also, hey, this is kind of fresh and cool and new. We pitched to home video, and we pitched to someone who, I mean, had no idea what a Klingon was or anything about Star Trek.
He wanted to know when Superman was going to show up.
Right. Right. And so that didn't go all that well. But I think as far as the website goes, they were anxious to have something new because obviously they were just stuck posting summaries of episodes and things like that. And it was also kind of a way for us to sneak in and get it done. I mean, we don't have the credits to go into CBS and pitch it as a TV series to air on television because they're just not going to listen to us. But starting kind of sneaking in that way was a good plan. And it was also doing it in animation was a way we felt to bring in younger viewers who might not know anything at all about Star Trek, but it's a cartoon. And so maybe they'll kind of get into it.
Yeah,
and
so that leads me to one question I had, because you were going to do it as a series of 5-6-minute shorts on StarTrek.com. Was there an indication that maybe if those were very successful, was there the possibility that this could evolve into a full-fledged animated television series down the road? Did you get any signals like that from anyone?
I think there was always the possibility that we would then get to do maybe more shorts or more of that kind of thing, but it never progressed to... You know, if this is successful, then we'll do an animated series. It was always, if these are successful, and then we can get, you know, and based on whatever revenue we garner from this, from these, and, you know, if we get a lot of hits on the site, then maybe we can do more of them. So that's why it was a pilot, yet it stood alone, and it definitely had a beginning, middle, and end. Mm-hmm. And then it had sort of a tag at the end for what could happen next. And we certainly, in our pitch, we pitched, stories and where this could go and what, you know, and in our heads we were obviously like, okay, well we have, you know, ideas as to, you know, what the season would be and what, you know, further things down the line would be.
But yeah, we had an overriding arc. I mean, we had an entire arc for a season of the show that would have blown people's minds.
Yeah, and we had plans beyond that too, but I don't know. Didn't happen.
I think internally we always hoped that it, you know, if it were to catch on, that sure, it, you know, that we would get the call to, you know, to TV, but it just never moved on past that because at some point everyone at StarTrek.com, in fact, CBS Digital was fired. They were all let go and the division was dissolved and with it our concept.
Yeah, that was interesting. I didn't realize that everyone had been laid off until I read it on your site, but I do remember right around that time was when the StarTrek.com site just seemed to just languish away for a couple of years.
I seem to recall it was about a week before Christmas.
It was
that they did
a week before Christmas they let everyone go.
And it was shortly thereafter that the whole JJ Star Trek thing was announced. I think we were talking to people when that happened, and that certainly didn't help things in as so far as like Paramount Motion Pictures, they had a plan. They had J.J. Abrams rebooting Star Trek. You know,
in itself brought a lot of legalities to it.
Exactly.
If he is doing it, that no other form of Star Trek can be done by CBS. And there was kind of quid pro quo thing that goes on between the two companies because they do profit share against the intellectual property.
That's the complicated stuff that the fans don't see.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
No. It gets very, very messy, very, very quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm.
So, I was also in looking at the concept of the animated series, and of course, there's kind of an influence from Clone Wars here. And the animated, original Star Trek, the animated series, being a 1970s Saturday morning cartoon, had more of a kid's feel to it. But in looking over the Final Frontiers, I get the feeling that at least in the setup, like you said earlier about breaking down the Federation and how everything had gotten so advanced, you know, you have this concept of this disruption of subspace. So it kind of like throwing, like if we were to be thrown back a few hundred years, I guess, in our technology today. And it felt a bit like this show, this concept, has a kind of Dominion War atmosphere to it in terms of kind of the turmoil of the Federation, kind of a darker theme that's more suited to adults. But then as we read through the script, I get the feeling that Captain Chase kind of wants to get back more towards the helping hand ideals of the Federation. Is that where you were heading with the overall story?
A lot of the feedback that we get, you know, the stuff on the website, there's a whole background section that talks about the war and the history. And the history of it all is very dark. And a lot of people go to the site and they read that and then they stop and they say, oh, it's Battlestar Galactica. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to see people getting murdered and all that stuff. But then, you know, we always tell people that's the background and that's the darkness that we're trying to get out of. And if you actually read the script, you see that it's not about war and darkness and death. It's a lot more fun than that.
Yeah.
And so that background is definitely dark, but the entire thing was kind of meant to take Star Trek, the franchise itself, out of that dark time and into the future. And so that's what we were doing in the show as well.
My problem with Star Trek Insurrection is that it sort of tries to take the Federation a dark place and doesn't quite do it. Whereas I feel like what you did was go ahead and send the Federation to that dark place and then show a stark parallel with your star crew to show like how good can still come about.
Yeah, by the time we start our sort of our drama, a lot of time has passed between that really dark time and the Federation's sort of like in the doldrums. They're kind of just treading water. And what we wanted to do with Chase and the crew of this Enterprise was to have them sort of be this bright light in this sort of very, I don't know, not dark, but very gray.
Dimly lit room.
Yeah. It was they you know, there wasn't any spark in the Federation to go out and actually try to do anything or to be anything more than just to kind of protect where they were and or what they had left, right? And so, but we wanted Chase to be that bright light and the Enterprise
that
there.
Flare.
Yeah, yes.
Chase is the lens flare at the Final Frontier.
I'm going to stick with light. We wanted him to be definitely more adventurous. And you know, like Dave was saying, Star Trek is a much more sort of plot theme heavy show than say Star Wars. But it doesn't mean that it can't have action. And we wanted the show to have both, and animation was going to be something where we could really have a lot of fun with, you know, with Star Trek action while still sort of keeping themes alive.
Right. And a few other breaks with Star Trek in the past is that you actually have the first captain that's not born on Earth. And also you have this very unusual spatula Enterprise design.
Hammerhead.
Thanks, guys.
Hammerhead.
Thanks for that.
Or
everybody has to talk about the ship, Doug. Doug loves the ship. You know, the thing about I'll talk about the Enterprise first, and I'll let the guys talk about the captain. The thing about the Enterprise was that we were dead set and determined to not make it a roundish secondary hull and two engines sticking out the back. It just every Enterprise has followed kind of that theme. We trying to get three guys that love Star Trek to design an Enterprise is a tall order.
It's a nightmare.
It really,
are we allowed to curse on this podcast?
Yeah. It was really, really hard. So one of the things Dave did was he brought in Mike Okuda to one of our meetings and we talked for a really long time about the Enterprise and how they, you know, came about doing the D and all that stuff. And one of the things, you know, and he basically broke it down into he's like, every redesign that you ever see of the Enterprise, they just kind of move the pieces around.
Right.
Hmm. Or, you know, every time you see a fan, you know, sort of do like an alternate Federation ship, they just move these three elements around, the secondary hull, the saucer section, and the engines. And he said, and one of the things he said to us was, what you should do is radically redesign one of those pieces. Then it's still recognizable as Star Trek, but not the same. And we thought about that for a really long time and thought it was a really good idea. I mean, you don't take Mike's word lightly. And we really wanted to redesign the dish. And part of the reason was that the Federation had become, had gone through a war. They'd become more aggressive. They weren't as open and as friendly. And we wanted the spacecraft to reflect that. So sort of having that very friendly round dish and all of that wasn't something that we wanted to portray, you know, right away. We wanted something that looked a little bit more threatening. Now, frankly, we never got a final design on that that we were super duper happy with. You know, there were elements of that flat head dish that we really liked, and you know, we were headed towards something. I don't know if we quite ever nailed it.
No,
we didn't.
But yeah, changing the dish to something that was a little bit more threatening, more imposing, was something that we really thought about as like, well, this is representative of what the Federation has gone through, and this is what's out there now. Now, again, then that again, by having that ship, it's in stark contrast to our captain and our crew and stuff like that. So it's, you know, it's all just working with the history and working with themes.
And something that I really wanted to get across is that in an allegory sense is that this Enterprise should also have to reclaim. You know, when you read the script, you realize this is not a ship of the line. This is not one of their top ships. It's this kind of border patrol ship, and it's been, you know, buried out in a bunch of other ships, and it's just a name. And
it's not even the 1701.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I, you know, not only did I want Captain Chase to kind of snap the Federation leadership heads and say, you know, look, there's a greater destiny for us out here, but I also wanted that to happen with the Enterprise. I was really, really comfortable with the idea that viewers would not like the way that Enterprise looked, because as the show went on, they would like it.
Yeah.
They would learn to like it, and that's allegory to the entire concept of the show. So I was kind of, you know, I think we were goofing around on a chat room one day, the three of us, and I sent Jose and Doug this thing that I drew, and I am by no means any kind of artist, but I just drew a square. And I said that, you know, with like engines coming off of it, not like a Borg cube, but it was just like this block with, and I was like, dude, that, here it is, guys.
Here's your Enterprise.
There's the Enterprise, you know, but it was all this kind of thought process with all of us that we wanted the Enterprise to reclaim its glory. And I just think it would have been really cool for people who didn't like the way that ship looked to kind of get into the show and eventually learn to love that ship.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And in addition to this design with here, you also had the claw design.
Oh yeah, oh, right. Yeah.
We worked with a couple different artists, and at points we just said, hey, what would you like an Enterprise to look like? Some of them were Star Trek fans, and some of them weren't. Yeah. And the claw was something that we always.
I mean, it was cool to look at. I think we all looked at it originally. We're like, that's a little too,
a little too
harsh.
What I was thinking when I saw it was that somehow, you know, as things broke, there was the war, and as things broke down, that somehow tractor beam technology doesn't work anymore. And so you approach a ship and you just you say deploy the claw, and then the claw grabs the other ship and drags it off somewhere.
I like it. That's good.
That's great.
And then you asked a question about Chase. I'm sorry, I wanted to go back to that.
I thought it was really interesting that he wasn't actually born on Earth.
Yeah, because all captains in the past have always been born on Earth. Even though you have these diverse crews, the captains of the main ships on the shows, anyway, are always humans. And
did we do that on purpose?
Well, I think
I can't remember.
It wasn't necessarily that he wasn't born on Earth. It was that we wanted a captain that was of the world, so to speak. Mm. That hadn't been living on Earth, that actually knew what it was like to live on these planets that are completely cut off from the Federation, and that had spent the better part of his life, you know, trying to escape that to get to a place where, you know, they could use warp travel. And then so we wanted someone of that world to be the captain, because part of it is that I think if you were on Earth when all of this happened, or if you grew up on it, there's a certain, there might be a certain prejudice, a certain, and even a certain acceptance of the status quo. And with Chase not having been a part of that, having been separated and having to sort of fight his way and get out of that to then join the Federation and become a captain, his arc is a little bit more, it's more interesting, and it's more tied into the world. You know, it's not just another Earth captain. He was somebody who basically spent the better part of his life on a spaceship, you know, and therefore has this sort of love of space and what it means to explore and see new things.
And kind of a knowledge of the playing field. He understands these anomalies that you have trouble flying through, and he's mapped some of them, and he having spent all this time on a ship to get from one place to another, he has an in-depth view of it, and that makes him an attractive applicant to Starfleet as well.
It was just important for us to be for him to be of the world. I think
right.
that he didn't just he wasn't an outsider, you know,
yeah.
right. to the problems that the Federation had.
Right,
and they played that with people like Chakotay or Kira. But it's never been the actual head, the person who was in charge.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, there was a lot of promise in characters like Chakotay and Kira
until episode two.
Yeah.
Oh well. Yes. That's always the problem.
And yeah. Exactly. And that promise is never fulfilled. So it was like, well, why make him the second in command? And I like the fact that our second in command was sort of the more. Was to us, I think, a little bit more of the stereotypical
right.
captain. He's definitely the career captain. He's
right.
he's much more cut in the mold of a Picard, really, or
Well, he's deeply ensconced in
yeah, exactly.
in what the Federation and what Starfleet is at that time. So to
right.
him, the way Starfleet is going right now is right. Defense of your territory. Outsiders are bad. You know he's a very capable man. He's a very smart man, and you know we had this idea that he's up for his own command, and when Chase gets put to the Enterprise, they feel he's just a little bit too much of a wild card, and so they delay Holden's
command to make him first
promotion,
officer of the Enterprise,
and they make him first officer of the Enterprise. So he's immediately got this. This thing against Chase.
Yeah.
That now he's got to babysit this guy when in fact he should be the captain.
Yeah. There's a built-in tension to those two characters right away.
And you're going to keep that tension going as opposed to, like you said in the second episode, where
I'll keep it going as long as it makes sense.
Yeah, as long as it makes sense.
All tight.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, eventually right. men that serve together, you know,
you can have a grudging admiration for
yeah.
people and still, you know, hold true to your beliefs, and that's kind of, I think, where we were going.
And right. you know, men that start, how do you call it, tour together, you know, as enemies, you know, after trial and tribulation, you know, could end up the best of friends, but that doesn't have to happen right away.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
that can take some time. You can take as much time as you'd like to get there.
Right.
Very interesting.
So if we talk a little bit about the art style of Final Frontier, it's a bit different than what we're accustomed to in Star Trek. Obviously, it's different than live action stuff, but those who know the original Star Trek animated series, which was very 70s cartoonish, here there's a lot of influences. I know being in Japan, I feel a lot of influences from manga styles. And you mentioned DC before and so forth. What type of inspirations did you have in developing the look and feel of the characters and the environment?
we got really lucky. We had no budget. I mean, we spent some money on designs and artists and things like that, but this was our money. It wasn't like we had all this money to throw around. And so we through a friend of Dave's got hooked up with Jeff Parker, who is an artist, a comic artist, and now a comic writer. He does a lot of Marvel stuff. He did X-Men First Class and a bunch of other things.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And so we
had a rough. We had a friend of ours was did some initial designs for us, and then we gave those designs to Jeff.
Yeah, so we knew what the uniform pretty much looked like.
Yeah, and then Jeff kind of knocked it out of the park.
And we knew like we want Chase. If it were live action, we want Chase to be like a young Clooney or whatever. I mean, we gave him some guidance, but Jeff did designs for Chase, Holden, and Donnell. And because we needed them for the pitch. And on his first pass at them, we were just like, wow, this is amazing. It was so cool to see these guys in an actual style that wasn't like us sketching something out. Yeah. And
as far as art style is concerned, I think one of the things we always talked about whenever we talked to animation companies or we talked to whether it was other designers or other artists was Darwin Cook.
Yeah.
I mean, we really New Frontier, the DC book. It was a really big, I think, influence on how we kind of what we kind of wanted out of, especially out of Chase. He was not Hal Jordan Green Lantern like, but the way that Darwin draws faces and a very very strong line, but also a very angled line, mm-hmm. but not to the scent of like a Bruce Timm doing yeah. DC guys. There's a simplest and yet a sort of strength to the way his figures are put together. That is really amazing, and so he was a really big influence. Obviously, the Clone Wars stuff was a big influence on us. The Tarkovsky stuff, especially, mm-hmm.
and the DC stuff,
and then a lot of the DC animated stuff, because we all grew up watching Justice League and Superman right. yeah. and Batman and all that stuff. So I mean, I think a mix of those three were probably some of our strongest influences.
And then we also threw out elements that we wanted. So you know, for instance, we wanted the uniforms to go back to something a little more kind of, you know, we're telling the story that takes place in the future, but we wanted as much kind of a retro feel to things as we could get, kind of throwbacks to, you know, that's why you look at the characters have the kind of pirate pants, you know, with the cuffs that come out of their boots.
And, yeah, we were very adamant about bringing yellow back to command and
yeah.
and right. things like that. One of the
and
first
the red shirts I loved from the script.
Yeah,
actually calling him red shirts.
Yeah, we were really. That was a big thing. Like we wanted them to own that word. Like I wanted red shirts not to be a joke anymore.
Right.
Well, I mean it is a joke to a certain. I mean in the script, but
yes.
we wanted it not to be a joke.
Right.
Like, they should claim that name and make it something sort of a point
of
pride.
When our red shirts go down to a planet on an away team or a landing party, you know they may get their asses kicked, but you know they're going to take some people with them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very important not to make the security team just cannon fodder.
Especially in a series where we knew that we had to have a lot of action in it just
right.
to get, you know, to get viewers in. So we had to make sure that there was a team that could do some cool stuff.
Yeah. And I liked having the division colors be like the whole shirt again. I feel like the live action has been making the colors less and less part of the uniform.
Yeah,
I think in live action that works a little better to have them in black with the piping or with mm-hmm. subtle hints. But in animation, you do want it to be bold. You want it to mm-hmm.
yeah.
you want it to be bright to a certain extent. And so bringing back the colors and the full colored shirts was a big deal.
I was going to ask you about the uniforms because from a design standpoint, I really like the first militaristic ones that you have there that are mostly black.
With the thing over the shoulder and the pin on the end of it?
Yeah, and just the stripe
yeah.
coming down the center that has the color.
That never would have worked
yeah,
in animation.
I
they
love the
been
design.
Black blobs.
But, right, exactly.
It would have been really bad.
But then what you said on your blog there about that would kind of just turn into a blob in animation.
Yeah.
What other challenges... Along those lines, as you're developing things, what other challenges in creating this for animation caused you to change some of your original concepts and ideas?
It's interesting because one of the reasons that we chose animation from the beginning was that you could do things that you can't do in live action. You know, you can mm-hmm. do zero gravity and giant alien ruins and planets and all that stuff. And then what was interesting was once we sat down with some animation companies and started going over budgets, you know, in order to make this as possible, we had to keep the budget down because, you know, it was a website that we were working with. And so some of those challenges, some of that stuff we actually just couldn't even do because even in animation, budget for the big stuff kind of enters into it. So that was kind of interesting. I would say that the main challenge that we faced was – almost it's more to do with format than with animation, and that was breaking the story down into 6-minute pieces. And we're working in Star Trek, you know, in in Clone Wars, they did a whole episode with no dialogue, and it was one of the best ones, with the stormtroopers just doing hand signals throughout the whole thing. We can't do that because we're Star Trek, and it's got to have people talking.
Right.
And to do a story in six-minute chunks, I mean, we didn't really even succeed, because I think if you actually filmed our script, it would be longer than that.
Yeah, but the script that's on the website isn't... I mean, we went ahead and just added everything to it.
Right, well, we would have... I'm not saying we would have gotten it down to 6 minutes, but it was... You know, we were used to writing longer form than that, and so fitting things in so that there's an actual story in each segment, so that there's some action, so there's a logical place to end. It was really challenging to tell a story like that, and yet it was also by the end of it was really fun.
It was
to think like that.
Yeah, I mean, there was a couple of scenes. There's a flashback scene, I think, in part three where the Ordrin are kind of talking about how the Verlicon, thank you. The Verlicon, invaded their homeworld. And I think originally we were like, oh, we'll just make this whole thing. And then the more we talked about it, it was like, okay, it's going to be a flashback. It's going to be all in silhouette. It's going to be, And so, little things like that, sometimes you don't have to rein back in your imagination. You just have to then figure out a different way of presenting it.
Yeah.
Than just, blowing it out. But I think that was kind of the bulk of it. It's just sometimes big scenes required us to scale it back a little bit and to think about how many locations we have and things like that. A lot of the stuff that you think about once you go into production, even on a live action.
Yeah, coming in mid-conversation, leaving before the conversation ends. I mean, anything you can do to kind of trim the fat.
Yeah. So it's a lot of the same. It's just the challenges that you have with story writing or production in general, more so than anything unique to animation.
I mean, we never got into production where like actual production where we might have maybe run up against a few more walls.
Yeah.
But in speaking with animation companies and then having looked at the script and whatnot, they never looked at it and came back to us and said, okay, you can't do this, or this is going to be way too expensive, or any of those things. It was, it was always a lot of this, economy of scale and trying to get in, get in late and leave early and things like that,
right.
But we never got hit with like, "Oh, you guys are—that's too much." You can't do that in animation.
Yeah, but I guess there's a couple movies. There's the Final Fantasy movie, and then Titan A.E., which each sort of bankrupted the studio that made them because the budget.
we actually looked at both of those because at one point we were
asked to look into doing it as a CG project,
right?
Yeah, and that would have been outrageously expensive.
We met with this company and. We got a budget back from this production person. It made us laugh pretty hard.
Oh, wow.
Just because we knew what kind of money we were told to shoot for. And yet, we were at the same time, we were told to go out and find out how much it would cost to do it as a computer animated project. And let's say those numbers did not match or come even close to each other. So, I mean, you can blow out Star Trek and kind of muck it up, but we were dead set on trying to not make it Star Wars and be more as story driven as we possibly could in 6 minute chunks. I mean, and that was hard.
Yeah. So this, I think you probably we went over this a little bit earlier, but you got through the in terms of getting this onto the website. It seemed to be progressing, and then the kind of the breakup happened with Paramount, CBS, and StarTrek.com kind of got put on the back burner as well. So before that happened, were you fairly close to being able to start producing some of this? Because I would have loved to have seen it. I was reading the script, and there are certain scenes in there that I'm thinking, wow, I would just love to actually see this on screen.
I think that everyone we were involved with and everyone we were talking to, we were all ready to go. If we could have hit a specific number, I think we would have been good to go. I just don't think it ever, it was just out of everyone else's control, unfortunately.
Yeah, it was like we got to a certain time and place where we were getting closer on the numbers and we were moving further up the chain. And you got the sense that further up the chain, they knew things that we didn't know.
Yeah.
Like perhaps there was going to be legal issues. Like perhaps there was going to be the split. Perhaps there was going to be a new movie. And there was a lot of like, okay, well, just hang on. We'll get back to you soon. And that time kept going and going and going. And eventually everything just fell apart, mm-hmm. and that was that. Right. So, but everybody that we talked to was really enthusiastic.
So, do you think there's any chance of them coming back around in the future and asking you guys to resurrect this project for StarTrek.com?
No,
I don't think
it's
so.
It's a whole different regime that runs the website. I don't even know.
They don't even know that it exists. It would be up to us to pursue that.
Yeah, and also, I mean, at this point, Paramount is focusing on the new Star Trek, which is JJ's universe.
Yeah. Yeah, they're pretty invested in that right
and
now.
And I would say they're not gonna take a chance on any other iteration of Star Trek for a while. So I mean, we'd love to do it as a comic book, perhaps, or as something else, we got the website up so people can see what we were doing. But I don't. I would doubt that.
Yeah, I mean, Paramount and CBS Paramount anyways is pretty heavily invested into the J.J. Abrams vision of Star Trek and as Star Trek that there is no, there is nothing else but to do anything new with. And I don't think they'd ever go back to the sort of TNG timeline, so to speak.
Yeah, that's something we've talked about a good bit on this show, actually, is whether on television they would ever pick back up where TNG DS9 Voyager left off or somewhere down the road. You know, we kind of feel that eventually there will be something else on TV, we think, but what will that look like? Who knows?
Exactly.
And probably not a continuation.
Yeah, they'd be crazy not to do another TV show, but I'm sure that it will spring from the movie.
Yeah, it'll be either in that same time as the Enterprise is, or it'll be like TNG where they just go forward and and it's a whole other crew and an Enterprise or something like that, because it's one of the things that we talked about a lot when we were talking about the show. Was one of the big questions right away was, should it be the Enterprise? And I know Dave felt really strongly that the Enterprise needs to be there, and it's such an integral character, really. Mm-hmm. It's not just a ship, it's a character.
Exactly.
So I would think that they would do something like that. And it's just a matter of time. I think from what you read and see and stuff like that, I think they're pretty invested in the films right now, and maybe when those start to go away or they don't do as well or they're not gonna do them anymore or whatever, they'll dovetail into television. Mm. But I think right now Paramount's got that kind of locked up. Mm.
So as for you guys, I can tell from your website that bit by bit you guys are still developing the Final Frontier concept, at least for your own enjoyment anyway.
Sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night and I have an idea and I have to write it down and put it on the website. Yes.
You mentioned that you'd like to do it in a comic book form or something down the road. Do you think there's a possibility that we're going to see this, at least from you guys, in some form that we can enjoy apart from just the storyboards down the road?
We talked last year. I think I even put on the website that we were going to continue and write scripts.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's four pages of a script that are admittedly pretty awesome.
I think you said there's a few great verbs after that, right?
Yes, exactly. It's a lot of fun to write, and we're still talking about these characters 5 or 6 years later. Like, these characters are all important to us, and we'd love to tell their stories, but at the same time, Dave has two kids, Jose has one kid, I have a cat. We all have jobs, and it's tough to find time to actually do that. And so, look, we know where it's going, and there are still stories that we want to tell. You'll eventually see more. It's probably just going to be some scripts on a website with maybe some pictures, And if we could do it as a comic, that would be great. We've had people contact us on the site and be like, hey, let's get some fans together and animate it and just do it as a fan project. Yeah. And that's, we see the project in our minds a certain way, and there's no way to achieve that with, no matter how many dedicated people we get together, it's not going to look as good as we want it to look, and no one gets to make any money off of it, which is a huge, huge problem when you're asking people to do a lot of work.
Yeah, right.
So,
well, I hope we'll keep following the scripts anyway. And the artwork and hopefully one of these days we will see it come to fruition.
Yeah, I mean it's definitely a never say never kind of thing. Mm. But we're also realists. I mean, we did this. I think we're coming up on 3 or 4 years now since we.
It's more than that.
More than that.
Is it 2005? I think we started it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I guess I didn't. Wow. Yeah, we didn't have kids. That's how it was.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it's been, 5 or 6 years now. So, I mean, I know that Doug and I are still amazed whenever it comes back into consciousness. There's that blaster article on sci-fi.com's website not too long ago about the 10 Star Trek things that never happened. And they put us at number 10, and he gave me a call. He's like, holy shit. Yeah, I was completely flabbergasted that somebody still thought of us and had nice things to say instead of what an ugly ship.
That article was bookend, right? The 10 things that never, Star Trek things that never happened. Number 10, Final Frontier, the animated series. Number one, Star Trek 5, The Final Frontier. The article of wishful thinking.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah,
rather see your show than Rikers in Space. Which,
well, thank you very much.
We agree. Awesome in that article.
Yes. We obviously love the heck out of it and feel really passionate about it. And if the opportunity presents itself where we can do it justice in animation or it's all basically for us. It's about doing it justice. I mean, we don't want to just do it to do it. We wouldn't want to just animate it just to have it animated. Right. We would want to do it to make it good and fun and
be representative of what our idea was.
Yeah, and if that could ever happen, then we're all over it. But until then, it lives in the form in which it's in.
So if anyone has a couple million dollars that they just want to throw our way. Our email is on the website.
Yeah, we'll animate that sucker right away.
Yeah, we'll put a link in the show notes if anyone wants to send a couple of million dollars.
Yeah, we'll start a kick. We'll set up a Kickstarter website and
target
we'll it from there.
$3 million.
No, obviously we love it and we put a lot of time and effort into everything from the characters and the dynamics that are going on the ship to. The world and the war and what that all really means and, what this mystery is that Chase is chasing out there, and all of that stuff. So, there was a lot of places where this thing was going
to
go.
Yeah, and, I mean, ultimately, you have to do these things for yourself because, if you go on websites where it's been listed and, there's a million different viewpoints from Star Trek fans because everybody has their kind of own thing, that they want to see out of Star Trek. And, we felt it was important to inject what we did into it and craft it the way we did. And we put a lot of thought into what we wanted to see and how, where we felt Star Trek was flawed right now and how to fix that and how to kind of recapture that kind of sense of wonder and action and fun that it used to have, and so we'd love to see it progress, but ultimately you have to do these things for yourself.
And also it doesn't totally fit as well as it would have back then, because like we said earlier, we were trying to take the whole show is an allegory for where the franchise was before the Abrams movie was even announced.
Right. Yeah.
And now that the movie has come out and it did really well and it was fun and optimistic and there's a lot of people who like Star Trek again, who didn't necessarily like Star Trek, the allegory is not exactly the same. Hmm. And so a big part of what was behind the show doesn't totally apply anymore, which isn't to say that we couldn't tell some awesome stories with them, just not quite as needed as it was back then.
Yeah, right. Okay, well, thanks a lot, guys, so much for joining us today and talking about Final Frontier.
Yeah,
this
so
was
much.
Extremely interesting.
Yeah, thanks for having us,
yeah,
man.
Thanks
it's
for
always,
having us.
Like Jose said, it's always fun when this thing comes back up again, and it was great to hear that you guys were interested and wanted to talk about it.
Again, that was Dave Rossi, Doug Mirabello, and Jose Munoz of Zero Broom Productions. You can find out more about the Final Frontier series by visiting their website at zeroroom.squarespace.com, and you can also catch their podcast, The Zero Room, by visiting thezeroroom.net.
Well, that was great to have Dave and Doug and Jose with us this week.
Yeah, definitely. I'm so glad they could be on because I liked what I saw of Final Frontier, mm-hmm. reading Zero Room's website. But just hearing it firsthand, the creative process from them and what was going on behind the scenes really elevates what you can find out on the website to a new level. And I really wish that show had been produced.
Yeah, it was a really fascinating story to get into. And now, of course, I want the show so much more than I did when I just saw it mentioned on Memory Alpha. Now I'm like wishing I could watch an episode tonight.
Yeah, same for me, especially reading some of the script and some of the action sequences that were going on. But, you know, we can always hold out hope that as Star Trek continues to be resurgent and StarTrek.com continues to be resurgent, that at some point maybe this will actually happen.
Yeah, you never know.
You never know. So before we leave everyone today, we just want to tell you how to get in touch with us. You can always leave us a message if you have thoughts on anything that we talked about on our website. Just go to trekfm/contact and you can send us a text message. And if you want to leave us a voicemail, give us a call at 646-652-TREK. And while you're on our site, be sure to pick up our newsletter, the weekly Hyperchannel newsletter. It has news, features, articles, exclusive content. You can get that by going to trek.fm/subscribe. And one more thing while you're on the website is to play Trek Trivia. And Greg, I did a special Trek Trivia theme just for you this week, which is the All-Spock quiz.
Right. I loved going through the quiz. I did not get all the questions right, but I really enjoyed going through the questions this week. There was one question in particular that I really loved, but I'll leave it to our viewers to find out which one that was.
Okay. I think I know what you're talking about.
Okay.
And if I'm not mistaken, that's also our poll question this week.
I think so.
All right. So play Trek Trivia by going to trek.fm/trektrivia. And also follow Trek Trivia on Twitter, where Mark Stamper and Anthony Davis conduct live quizzes several times a week. And while you're on Twitter, you can follow Trek FM. Our username is simply Trek FM. And Greg, you're on Twitter as well?
I am. I'm there at Greg Harbin. That's GREGHARB as in boy, IN.
All right. And you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. Mm. And we'll have links to these in the show notes and on the Enhanced podcast as well. And one more thing. We always forget to mention this, but we're also on Facebook, Greg. So if you go to facebook.com/trekfm, you can like us on there, and we'd be ever so grateful.
Please like us. Please.
Please like us. Please. All right. Well, Greg, it looks like another show has been wrapped up.
Yeah, Chris, I think it's time to stick a spatula in it, because the Ready Room is done.